Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you listening. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. People in France and in Spain had known for a long time, probably hundreds of years, that in places in their countries there were caves that had beautiful and mysterious paintings of animals on the walls. But it wasn't until about 1900 that it was established that these paintings were the work of prehistoric people. And it was at around that point, says our guest this morning, author Gregory Curtis, that questions about who had made these paintings and when and why began to be asked. This morning in this hour of focus, we'll be talking with Gregory Curtis about his recent book, The Cave Painters, the subtitle Probing the Mysteries of the World's First Artists. This book is published by Knopf. It's just come out recently. And it, among other things, explores some of the various theories that have been put out about these paintings and what they meant to the artists who made them, and perhaps also what it is they mean to us and why it is that they continue to fascinate us. The book is out now in the bookstores, and certainly if you want to look at it, you can seek it out. Our guest is the author of another book about another famous work of art, The Venus de Milo. The title of that book is Disarmed, The Story of the Venus de Milo. He was editor of Texas Monthly from 1981 until 2000. His work has appeared in a number of places, including the New York Times and the New York Times Magazine, Fortune, Time, and Rolling Stone, among other publications. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the number here for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And at any point here, you want to pick up the telephone, give us a call, you're certainly welcome to do that. Mr. Curtis, hello.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks. And yourself?
Very well, thank you.
You know, I think that probably a fair number of people who are listening to us will have seen some kind of reproduction of the work that we're talking about. They've seen it in a book. The power of the work is there, even if you see it that way. But I'm sure that to go into one of the caves, as you did, and as some people have had the chance to do, the experience is completely different. What is it like when you can actually see these paintings in sight?
Well, that's a really interesting point, because we're used to seeing art either in reproductions, as you say, or in museums or art galleries. And but the paintings, these paintings are in caves, and they're on cave walls. So first of all, you're down underground. You need an artificial source of light to see them. Caves are spooky. They seem to be alive. The water drips. You can hear sounds. You feel if you, you might get lost if you're not careful, these kinds of things. So it's not as secure as being, you don't feel as secure as you do in a gallery and such. Plus, the cave walls are not uniform, of course. They roll, they undulate, there are cracks, there are bulges and so on. And the paintings there are there on the wall, so they too take the shape of the wall. And the artists frequently would try to look at places on the wall that suggest, to find places on the walls that suggested animals, and then their painting would follow the curves or the cracks or whatever it was in the wall that suggested the animal, in a way that to kind of bring the animal out of the wall, as if the animals were there in the wall already, and the painting was just a way of making them recognizable or bringing them up out of the walls. The other thing that you see when you see them in the caves is the relation between individual painting and the other paintings around it. And generally speaking, these paintings are not like an individual painting, an individual painting, an individual painting. They tend to be part of large compositions that relate to one another. So you see that, and it's almost impossible to get that in a photograph. And then it's important where the paintings are in the cave, or in other words, are they close to the entrance? Are they deeper into the cave? Are they in a large room, or are they in a narrow passageway? In order to see them, do you have to get down on your knees and crawl, or can you stand up? All these things are possible, and they're important in terms of how the painting was made and what it could possibly have meant.
Mm-hmm. What do we know about when these paintings were made?
Well, the oldest paintings that we know are in a cave named Chauvet, which is in the Ardèche in southern France. And those paintings have been radiocarbon dated, and they date to about 32,000 years ago. The painters in those caves, in that cave in Chauvet, used charcoal to make their black pigment. So that's how it's able to be radiocarbon dated, because the charcoal is organic material and you can get the carbon date from that. The newest cave that has paintings is about 10,000 years old. So, and so that the practice of painting in caves in this area lasted for about 22,000 years. And throughout that time, although there are variations, basically speaking, throughout that time, it was a constant cultural tradition. It lasted that long, 22,000 years. By contrast, the pyramids of Egypt are 4,500 years old, only 4,500 years old. So the pyramids are like infants compared to how old these paintings are.
I think another, there are so many interesting things about these paintings, but another interesting feature is that they seem to have been a regional cultural feature, in the sense that here in this area, northern Spain, southern France, it's the, at least as far as we know, it's the only place that you see them. You don't find them anyplace else.
That's right. There was a broad, people were clear across Europe and Asia at this time, and there were extensive patterns of trade from one to another, and they made carvings on bones and on rocks and so on that we find across the European landscape and well into Russia. The only place where people painted in caves is there in southern France and northern Spain, on one side or the other of the Pyrenees, even though they were part of a similar culture and did have contact with other people who didn't paint in caves. And in some cases, for instance, in Russia, there weren't caves. There were plains, and so there weren't caves to paint in. But in other places, for instance, Germany, there are plenty of caves, and there were people living there at the time, but they didn't paint in them. It was a localized phenomenon. And one thing to remember is what happened was that people, Cro-Magnon men, they're often described in early textbooks. Now, the term is anatomically modern humans, AMH. Anyway, anatomically modern humans originated in eastern Africa and migrated north from there through the Levant, and then split, some groups going east into Asia and other groups going west across Europe, going east to west across Europe. They were north of the Alps, and if you think about it, in Europe, if you go from east to west in sort of a, let's see, northeast to southwest direction, there isn't much serious problem until you get to the Pyrenees, and those are mountains and can be difficult to cross. And then as you go farther west, of course, there's the Atlantic Ocean, which was couldn't be crossed. So this place where the paintings in the caves were done was not the center of the known world. It was a region. It was the boondocks in a way. It was the last place on earth. In their ways, literally the last place on earth. And that's where the practice began. It's also interesting that when people came across Europe, there was another hominid species there, the Neanderthals. And you can trace through the archaeological remains, you can trace the advance of modern humans and the retreat of Neanderthals. Neanderthals were clear all across Europe, and they retreated back in front of the advance of the modern humans. And the last place where the two groups lived together for any period of time was around the Pyrenees. And the two species lived together for about 5,000 years there in the Pyrenees. And some people have speculated that perhaps the birth of the cultural phenomenon of painting in the caves has to do with the fact that was the place where humans and the Neanderthals lived together for the longest time. That's just a speculation, though. There's no evidence and no way to prove it exactly. It just so happens that the Neanderthals and the caves are there at the same place at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Our guest is Gregory Curtis. He is the author of a recently published book, The Cave Painters, Probing the Mysteries of the World's First Artist, which is about what we know or what we think we know about the people who created this art that's found in caves in southern France and northern Spain, and particularly about a number of people over the years that have been captivated by this art and have spent a lot of time thinking about it, talking about it, writing about it, speculating on the meaning, convinced that there was meaning if it could simply be decoded. The questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Another interesting aspect of this, fascinating aspect, is when you look at the subject matter of the art, you can see that it's all about the animals, and not just any animals, but some particular animals. And as you point out, if you look at it, you realize that there are a lot of things, features of the natural environment that someone might have painted that's not there. There are no trees. There are no plants. There's no water features. The sun's not there. The moon's not there. There are no stars. And the people that are there are little more than stick figures. And you'd think that the animals are so beautifully done that the people who made them, you'd have to think, well, if they wanted to do human figures, they could do better than what they've done. So that apparently was not important to them. What was important was the animals, and particular animals.
Right, that's right. And we're now, since Homo sapiens are the dominant creature throughout virtually all the world now, we don't think of what the situation was back then in the Stone Age. And at that time, the situation was exactly reversed. There were teeming hordes of animals of all description, and there were very few people. At this time, in what is modern-day France, there could have been as few as 5,000 people. There were no more than, say, 40,000 people in all of present-day France, whereas, there were millions and millions of animals of all descriptions. So the world to them, to us, the world seems created for us, whereas to them, the world must have seemed to be created for animals and not particularly for humans. I mean, we don't know what their inner thoughts were, but it's quite possible that they felt like interlopers in a way, that they were strangers in a strange land, that they were guests of the animals in some way. I mean, that's all rank speculation, but it's one way of thinking about what the differences were. So in the paintings, the as you say, the important things were not people, but the important things were animals. And again, as you say, only particular kinds of animals. The most frequently painted animal is the horse. In all the caves we know about, there are more horses than all the other animals combined. And even in caves where in that particular cave there will be a different animal in the majority, often there will be horses placed in a particular special place at the center of things, for instance, showing that the horse, even though in that particular cave the horse doesn't dominate by numbers, still it holds a central role in what is going on. And the people at that time, although they did eat horses, they much preferred to eat reindeer. That was the animal that they ate most of all. And there are reindeer in the caves, but not very many. So one of the early theories about the caves was that they were some kind of hunting magic, that they were to get powerous in the hunt, perhaps, or to ask forgiveness from various animals for having killed them in the hunt, that kind of thing. But now we think that that's unlikely. And there are many reasons, but one reason is the simple one I just said. If it had been about hunting per se, there would have been many, many more reindeer, because that was the desired game, and not so many horses. And yet the situation is exactly the difference, is exactly the opposite. So horses had some primary in whatever the history, the mythology, the theology, whatever the thinking is going on in the caves, the horse had a special, dominant, particular place in it. The other thing about the animals, you're right, there's no landscape. You'd think living as they did, they didn't live in the caves, by the way, they lived, generally speaking, in rock shelters by rivers, but also they would take hunting trips and had camping sites around when they followed herds to hunt and so on. But they lived in they were exposed to the elements. They were at the mercy of wind and storms and sun and snow and cold and heat. Well, there wasn't that much heat, but cold. You know, the sky, there weren't electric lights and so on that dim out the sky. The sky must have been resplendent with stars. You know, lightning is very impressive. All these things, you'd think that they would be there since they were so close at hand and they were at the mercy of these elements, but they're just not there. The animals also aren't really doing that much. That's very interesting. Occasionally there are scenes of animals fighting. Occasionally there are wounded animals that maybe did seem to be pierced by spears or something. But basically speaking, they're not. They're just there. And they're in the prime of life. There aren't young animals or old animals, and there aren't wounded animals. Well, there aren't injured animals. There aren't they're all resplendent and in great health and just there. They're just there. It's really odd. It takes something. It takes some getting used to. You have to get over your assumptions about what you know, should be in those paintings, and just look at what actually is there.
Yeah. Well, and I know this is something that has fascinated people and has led to all kinds of speculation about what this is about, and that I know also, as you say in the book, that we really still don't have, many people have suggested answers. We really don't have one yet, but you would have to think that given all of the trouble they would have had to, these people would have had to go to make the paintings, the places that they put them, you would have to say there has to be some very important, they had to be saying something important.
Right.
And I suppose the impulse is that somehow if we think carefully enough, if we look at them enough, if we look at the images and how they're arranged and how they're composed and how they're paired, and look at all of the various things that are there, that somehow we would be able to figure out what these images meant to the people who put them there and why they did that.
Right. There had to have been, as you say, some very powerful cultural reason for them to go down into the caves. Often, the paintings are well back into the caves, and they took torches in, but most of the time, they had little handheld lamps that burned animal fat, and they would go in. The only light they had were these little lamps, which if you dropped one, the light would go out, and I think that would have been truly terrifying. So they were there, crawling or walking, exploring, and they tended to explore deep into the caves as far as they could. With just these lamps, it would be very frightening and a very brave thing to do. So there had to have been some powerful reason, whether of the culture, whether it was religious or a tradition or what, we don't know. But it drove them or lured them, propelled them down into the caves. And you do think when you're there that, well, this had to have been a religious reason, and certainly it could have been. But as I've looked at more caves and as I've thought more and studied more, I think that it and this is a speculation on my part, a deduction. It's not scientific exactly. I mean, I can't prove it, but I think that there was more than that. That I think of the caves not so much as cathedrals, let's say, or as places of worship, although they may have been that too, but as really sort of more like libraries. That there was the in the sense that a library today tries to have to contain the whole culture. There'll be everything that we know in a library, at least in intent. All our science, all our theology, for that matter, all our literature, all our history, everything is there. And I think in that sense, that's how the caves are too. That their knowledge, all of their knowledge, is there in the caves. All their science, all their mystery, all their history, all their mythology, and all their theology, all their religion, that's all there in those paintings. And it also could very well be that in those days that there wasn't that much distinction between or among these things as we have today, that history, mythology, theology, these things were all kind of the same, you know. They all, let's say there were stories. Well, the stories were both were theological and historical and mythological. All these combined into one.
We are a little bit past the midpoint. I have a couple of callers here. We'll get right to. And let me again introduce our guest, Gregory Curtis. He is the author of the book, The Cave Painters, Probing the Mysteries of the World's First Artist, published by Knopf. The book's out now if you want to take a look at it. He was, for a number of years, from 1981 until 2000, editor of Texas Monthly. His writing has appeared in a number of places, New York Times, Fortune, Time, Rolling Stone. He's also author of the book Disarmed, The Story of the Venus de Milo. Questions, welcome. Real quick, let me ask a question here, because I think we can take care of it pretty quickly. It was someone who was asking this question off the air when they heard your discussion of the fact that a lot of the animals that were pictured were horses. The caller was wondering, did they ride the horses?
No. There's a little speculation. There are a couple of papers that claim that in some carvings that they see evidence of halters, and also that there's some teeth of horses that they think show cribbing. If you know horses, you know what cribbing is. It's a kind of it's too complicated to explain here. But if horses are domesticated and in captivity, they might have cribbed even then, and they show evidence of this. But this isn't widely accepted, and it's just a couple of things anyway. So no, it doesn't seem like they had domesticated horses, or indeed any domesticated animals, including dogs or wolves or anything. They didn't have them. I've forgotten the date, the oldest date we know for certain when people rode horses, but it was well after this. I want to say 6,000 BC, but that could be wrong.
I was thinking that it was more like about 2,000 BC, but it was much more recent than what we're talking about.
Much more recent. Well, the events in the Iliad, those events are supposed to be 1200 BC, and obviously the horses were domesticated by then. So that's 3,200 years ago. So it's at least that old, but I don't know about any older.
Well, let's talk with some other folks here. We'll go to someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Yeah, I just had a curious question. You know, I haven't seen the caves that you're talking about, but we did recently have a vacation the last 2 years to the Four Corners area in the United States, where there are, I think they're calling petroglyphs. These are also sort of related to a cave painting concept where Native American Indians have drawn pictures, figures of people and animals and things of that nature, very similar to what you're talking about. What I was curious about was, if you were familiar with the timelines of these two things, if you could superimpose the timeline of what I was seeing in the Four Corners area with what you're describing in near the Pyrenees, and, you know, how far apart are they, or do they superimpose, or how would that work?
Right. I don't know the ages of those petroglyphs in the Four Corners area, but they're well after the time of the caves, of the cave paintings in France and Spain, well after the time. So,
is there any speculation that the Native American people here in the United States had migrated from, you know, in much earlier times from the European continent in some way?
Well, no, from Asia. The thought is, you know, across the Bering Strait and so on, and it's a long way in physical space and a long way in time from the cave paintings. So there's no direct relation.
I see.
But the phenomenon of painting on rocks is a universal phenomenon. They did it in early people did it in Australia. They did it here in North and South America. They did it in Africa, and this rock art, as it's called, is now the scholars of rock art, including the people who study the caves or specialize in study of the caves, tend to think of this as as I say, as a universal phenomenon that even though the particular instances of it, for instance, here in the New World or there in Australia or in Europe, they may not be literally derived from one another. They're taken to have come about from the same kind of basic human impulse that we all share. So they're studied as a unified phenomenon, as coming from somewhere within the human spirit.
Another form of communication. We're so good at communicating, it might be just another way.
Well, yes, and also preservation. In other words, the cave paintings were there was no writing, and similarly with the petroglyphs here. So in order to preserve the culture, in order to preserve the stories, in order to preserve the myths of where we came from and how the world was created, to put it down on, to put it on a rock or in a cave was a way of preserving it. When you think about it, there wasn't much else that would last. I mean, the people here, for instance, often put their genealogies, certain tribes did, put their genealogies on hides, but they knew quite well that those were very difficult to preserve and would disappear in time. So carving or painting on a rock was a permanent material that would leave that information, whatever it was information about, it would leave that information there permanently.
It's very interesting. I just want to say thanks for coming on the show. I thought it was a really interesting show.
Oh, good. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for the call.
I'll hang up and let the next caller take a turn.
Well, let's go on. We'll talk with someone next in Urbana, in fact, here, line number two. Hello.
I've just got another hypothesis for you about the origins of these things. It just strikes me that if somebody is living in a cave and...
They didn't live in the cave.
They used them in some fashion, though, right?
It's interesting. Yes, they went into the caves, and also it was both men and women who went into the caves, we know, and children, too. So everyone at some point or another could go into the caves, but they didn't go in there very often. There isn't much... points or tools.
They didn't leave a lot of detritus behind.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
There's very little of that. So they didn't go in very often, and they may have cleaned up behind themselves they left, although they very rarely cleaned up anything, so we don't think that. But they made their paintings or their engravings, and then they left, and they may have gone in once or twice after that or something, but basically speaking, they just went in, they did what they did, mm-hmm. then they came back out, and that was that.
Well, I guess my hypothesis is just that, take it for what it's worth, that these paintings, and the thing that sort of struck me was when you said they were very far back in the cave. It was sort of a message to whatever unknown underworld creatures were living beyond the place that was in the cave, beyond the place that was accessible to them, and that
it may be. But there are often paintings or engravings deep into caves, but often they're at the entrance as well.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, they can be throughout. Now they did. Sometimes, you know, depending on the configuration of the opening of a cave, there can be natural light that goes into a cave, sometimes surprisingly far, and they always went beyond that point. In other words, they didn't paint in the natural light. They always went off to beyond where the natural light extended. So
maybe that's just because they thought the natural light would fade their drawings.
That could be. I don't, you know, who knows? that could be. And yes, there as I was saying at the beginning, there apparently there was some the animals were there in the rock already, and the paintings were some way of bringing them out of the rock. And you know, did they were the herds then? Did they exist way deep in the cave beyond any accessible point, as you're suggesting, or were they just right there, right behind the surface of the wall? We don't know.
I wasn't necessarily suggesting that the animals that they cared about, that they wanted, were farther, came out of the cave, or that they thought that, but that is, I wasn't eliminating that either. I guess what I was thinking was that if they were actually sleeping in the cave, is what I was thinking, they were concerned about what was down there in the cave in parts that they couldn't see.
Yeah.
But you said they weren't sleeping in the cave. Maybe that's why they weren't sleeping in the cave.
Well, yeah, a cave is not for sleeping. The cave is not a very attractive place. They're wet for the most part,
yeah,
for one thing.
Well,
they're cold. They're damp, as I say. They're scary. You don't know what's down in there, and it's easy to imagine all kinds of all kinds of things. So yeah, I don't know. You know, you could be right. I don't know.
Okay.
All right.
All right, thanks
for the call.
Thanks.
Well, let's go on to line one. This is caller in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was fortunate enough to visit the caves of Altamira in northern Spain 50 years ago. I understand that they are now closed to the public because the breath of the visitors was damaging the paintings. But I remember particularly the phenomenon that you've been describing of the animals apparently being behind the rock. There was one bison which was charging, and it appeared as though it had it were turning a corner to charge directly at you, so that its hindquarters were on a portion of the rock that was behind, and then there was a portion that jutted forward, and the head was on that, so that the animal appeared to be coming directly at you. And I remember feeling very strongly that whoever had painted that must actually have been charged by a bison, which must be a terrifying experience. And
right.
So it had made a very deep impression on this artist. But as to the inaccessibility of the caves, we had to crawl in on hands and knees. And then only, I suppose it was maybe 50 feet, something like that, did the cave open up so that we could stand up.
Uh-huh.
They were wired for electricity, but with very dim bulbs, frankly,
right,
so that we could see the paintings. But I can well understand how they would be damaged by being visited. I might say that, incidentally, that those caves were in an area that was so remote from population, even 50 years ago, that the guide who went in with us told us that we could see mirror flashes up in the mountains, and he said that those were smugglers who were smuggling things back and forth across the French-Spanish border.
Oh, is that right? Uh-huh.
And that was the way they signaled each other.
Uh-huh.
So it was spooky in several ways.
Right.
But the thing that really struck me about this bison was that it was so real that it was charging you, and yet this was thousands of years before anyone even had the idea of perspective in painting.
Right. It was the technical level of the best of the paintings was not equaled maybe till the Renaissance.
I think that's true, and certainly this, as I said, you had the real feeling that this thing was coming straight at you.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, in other caves, depending on where you stand, sometimes it's obvious you weren't meant to see a particular painting from right in front of it, that you were supposed to see it from down the passageway a bit and look back.
True.
For this very reason that you say, it gives it a from that perspective, the painting has an animation that it doesn't have if you just stand right in front of it and look at it, because of the way that the wall, the curvature of the wall, or something like that. And the observation, for instance, at Chauvet, there's a pack of lions hunting, and which one thing it proves is that in those days lions hunted in packs, whereas mm-hmm. contemporary lions don't. But their eyes have a fierceness and intensity, and they took a lion expert, an expert in African lions, down into the cave to look at these lions, and he said that the intensity in those eyes was exactly like the intensity in the eye of a hunting lion today. But he said you have to be close to the lion and to see it, and that the only way he gets close to the lion is in his 4x4 that has protective wire or something, whereas the prehistoric hunter was there completely exposed,
they
close
were
enough to the lion
people.
To see those eyes.
Yeah, well, and that's true with this bison also, that the eyes are they're staring at you, they must have been, yes, extraordinarily brave folk.
Yeah,
and you could almost imagine that. I presume that they were either lance hunters or bow hunters. That they
not
must
both.
Have got, had to get that close to the end.
Yeah, right. Yeah, very
what
close.
An extraordinary thing, and I felt very fortunate to have the experience of seeing them.
Yeah, that sounds like a great trip.
And I'll look for your book. Thank you.
Well,
thanks
for the call. There's so much that is fascinating about this. I guess I am continually impressed by the level of style in the aesthetic sense. The remarkable command of line, the ability to convey, I think, the essence of the animal with great economy, and the kind of shading that today we would use an airbrush to do. All of that, it's just remarkable to think that, and I suppose what it does is you have to completely reassess what you think about quote-unquote primitive.
Oh, yeah, they weren't primitive
people.
No, that's a... I'm glad you brought that up. That's a huge mistake. They weren't primitive at all. And the other thing is that you mentioned the skill in drawing a line and so on. That's absolutely true. And also what it means is that they had schools, that they taught, or maybe not schools in the sense that we have, but they had a means of teaching from one generation to the next. They had a way of teaching people how to draw and how to paint, because in the paintings and engravings in the caves, there's very seldom a redo. They an erasure and redrawing something. They went down and they made their paintings. They drew their lines, and it was right the first time. And the skill with which they did it, you don't just go down into a cave and draw that line or draw that bison just without any practice and without any instruction. These people were the people who made the paintings were highly skilled and highly trained and highly practiced. So there had to have been some formal way to convey this knowledge from one person to another.
And it's interesting that the tradition, the style, the manner of doing them, say, so stable for such a long period of time. I think we have reason to believe that in a lot of places and times where there was an established tradition in art, a way of doing things, you have to believe that there were some artists who came along and said, no, I'm not going to do it that way.
Uh-huh.
I have my own way of doing it. And even if those people were dismissed and denounced, they still tried to do it their way, and we still have some of the work, and that's how things change, because someone comes along and says, I don't want to do it the way we've always done it. Were there any rebel artists, or did everybody else stay with the tradition for 22,000 years?
Yeah, no, that's, I know what you mean. You would think that there would be the great genius who comes along and just as you're saying, and looks at a bison and sees it in a way no one has seen it before, and yet when the artist then paints the bison the way that artist sees it, then everyone changes and say, oh my God, yes, that is how a bison looks. There's nothing like that. And yet, as I say, through the 22,000 years, and you see painters of great genius throughout this history. You know, it wasn't that it started out with a great flowering and then the others sort of, you know, and it sort of dwindled off across 22,000 years. It's not that way at all. It was very vital throughout that time. So they were producing, this society was producing artistic geniuses, you know, pretty regularly across 22,000 years. And yet they weren't revolutionary geniuses. They made their paintings for whatever reasons the society wanted, and they continued to do that generation after generation.
We just have a couple of minutes. We have, unfortunately, several callers. Not enough time for all of them. We'll try to do at least one. Champaign County, line one. Hello.
I'll try to be brief. And there was a documentary on PBS, and I can't remember many of the details. You may have even been a consultant to it or something, but it sort of looked at the creatures that they lived with and the creatures they painted and made a distinction. And they also mentioned that they thought it was an early sort of religious experience, and that they were suggesting that it was a hallucinogenic experience too, and that's a whole lot. And I'll just
I didn't see that particular documentary you mentioned, but yes, in my book, The Cave Painters, I do. That is one current theory about what might have been going on, and I discuss it in the book. But it's one way of looking at them, but it's not the only way, and it can account for some things, but it can't account for everything. So that's about that.
Yeah. There's a big part of the story that you tell in the book that we really haven't talked very much about. We've talked about the art itself. We've talked something about the people who created it and some of the ideas about what it was all about. I think that I just want to make sure people understand that in part also the book looks at various people along the way, starting with this man who was the Spanish aristocrat who discovered Altamira, who was the first one to say, I think that this was the work of prehistoric people, and then various people along the way, most of them French, I think, actually, who spent a lot of time thinking about trying to puzzle this out, this question, well, what really does this mean? And I don't know if people will find it unsatisfying, but the fact of the matter is that we really still don't have a good answer for that question.
Right. Well, I was fortunate in that the material, there's the cave painters, there's a story in the cave painters, and that is the story of the discovery that these paintings were made by prehistoric people, and then in the story of the battles among the people that studied the caves as to what they meant and what they are. So there is discussion about that, and these people are larger than life characters that were flamboyant in many cases and brilliant in every case, and they lived big and they make for a very good story, I think.
Do you think that we will ever have a definitive answer to that question, the question that everybody really ultimately wants to know?
I think we're going to get pretty close, to tell you the truth. Now what's happening is that they're doing very precise analysis of the relation of the paintings to one another. And I can't do justice to what that means in the short time left. But it the meaning in the paintings, we can deduce a lot once we understand the order the paintings were made, which animals are next to which animals are not next to each other, and things like that. It doesn't sound like it would be as fruitful a way of research as it truly is. So I think we're going to get pretty close. But you're right, we're never going to get completely there. We can't. There's no writing. There's no literal expression of their thoughts. There's only the image of their thoughts. Yeah.
And perhaps the most difficult thing of all is to putting your head in the same, so to speak, in the same space. That is, being up thinking about the world and your place in it the way that they did. Us, it's very difficult, maybe impossible.
Very hard. And yet, you can look at the painting, and that painter, 30,000 years ago, is communicating directly to you, because you can appreciate the beauty of that painting and the meaning in an imagistic way. You can tell it. So to that degree, you can look at those paintings and you are in contact with someone 32,000 years ago. Yeah,
a very interesting book, The Cave Painters, Probing the Mysteries of the World's First Artist, published by Knopf, by our guest Gregory Curtis. And Mr. Curtis, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, David. I really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.